friends. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Back from Europe, and I was gone this past week in Switzerland with my son at a family reunion, so I apologize for not being here last Friday. But I have returned and am almost fully mended from my infection that I got right as I'm on the plane on my way to vacation. I start coughing, and then within I'd say 24 hours I'm just in a bad state, and then I have to go to this family reunion, which was a wonderful evening, but went very late. So Daniel and I got back to the hotel about 1 a.m. And I had been, talking and talking and talking, and on top of it, I'm coughing. And so I wake up in the morning and I am just miserable and under the weather. Ended up in the emergency room with bronchitis, horrible. And then I, of course, still have to be on this trip, and I'm putting on a brave face for my son. And oh, so anyway, I am back and occasionally may need to spare you, take a minute or a second to press the cough button as I clear my airways. Now, with this said, and out of the way, so you understand where I've been this past week, I've come back to this terrible news out of New Zealand, and I'm just heartbroken. I am heartbroken by the kind of sick, awful things one human being can do to another. Now, one thing that I won't do on this program, and I've just decided it's journalistic malpractice, in my view, to talk about any of the perpetrators of these acts, because it's the notoriety, in my view, it's the fame-seeking, the attention-seeking, it's what they crave. They want to become a household name. They write these stupid, inane, bigoted manifestos that would be meaningless. Nobody would read it. It would just be drivel. It would just be nothingness, insignificant. But we, as media types, suddenly begin to pore over every word and every phrase. It's so important because why? Not because of this person's great intellectual stature, not because they have some brilliant new idea. Far from it. It's the same old idiocy and hatred, bigotry. But we're only reading their words and analyzing their words because they've committed a horrifying act. And to me, I think nothing dishonors the victims here more than this. I mean, more than naming. So I look at, I open up the media and now everybody's running with his name. I'm not going to do that here. This is an unprecedented act in New Zealand. New Zealand has widely been seen as a very safe country. It is statistically a very safe country. One interesting thing here that I believe will develop as a story in the coming days and weeks is the question of gun control. And that's because New Zealand, unlike, for example, its neighbor, its Pacific neighbor, Australia, New Zealand has relatively lax gun rules. They are similar to us in that there's a background check system, but there is not a universal registration scheme like they have in Australia. Now, the fact of the matter is, there'll be a debate about what role this played in this heinous act. But it does seem to me that the guy, I looked at some of the stills of the type of firearms used. It looks like he had semi-automatic assault rifles. So I couldn't tell exactly. I assume perhaps an AR-15 type weapon. We don't know yet if he had obtained these legally, if he had, if they were purchased on the black market. We don't know. But I'm still reeling from this, and we'll we'll address this more, I think, next week as we get more information. Now, as I look at this despicable human being and I see our own brave Gavin Newsom doing away with the death penalty, I want to wrap our heads around this thought. So here in California, if we, gosh forbid, wake up tomorrow to the news of some racist bigot shooting up a mosque and killing innocent men, women, children, we can't put him to death. And when I think about this, and this all happened while I was away, and in Europe, by the way, in Europe, they think that we are absolutely barbaric for having the death penalty. But when I look at, there have been mass shootings in Europe. I mean, there was a guy in Norway who, again, I'm not going to mention his name, but he shot up school kids on a trip, killed multiple teenage children. And he's sitting in a comfortable jail cell in Norway, probably, you know, eating scones and doing crossword puzzles in the lap of luxury, being rehabilitated. And I think in this discourse on the death penalty, there are people among us and acts so heinous that make perpetrators irredeemable. I just don't know. I look at this and I anyway. So here in California, if this happens now, thanks to Gavin Newsom, no gas chamber. Wait, we have the lethal injection. No death penalty. It's been suspended. So I guess we would get this person in our midst and in our public discourse, just like Manson. We'd just have him around forever, and he'd come up for parole every few years and could regale us with tales of how he's reformed and changed. So that is one thought that I had in all of this. All right. The other story that just exploded while I was out of town, and I want to spend some time on this because to me, this is huge on so many different levels. This college entrance cheating scandal is, I'll tell you, let me just begin with this for a second here. So we know that a number of prominent Hollywood types, Lori Loughlin, who to me, they're not household names. I guess she was on a number of famous TV shows. Then there's the other Felicity Huffman, who is a former or current Desperate Housewife. I'm very poorly versed in this. William Macy is her husband, a prominent actor. Anyway, these folks, right, Hollywood libs, through and through, Trump-hating, elitist, tell us how it's supposed to be, how we're supposed to live, how morally inferior we are. And I'm speaking now for us as conservatives, right? This is what we hear from the preachy Hollywood left-wing nut jobs out there. So these folks here, we now find out, have just blatantly bought their children's way into college. And not just through, I would say, front door donations, which is, by the way, a fairly common practice and is not part of the allegations here. I mean, you can, if you are very wealthy, and some of these parents, what did they pay? Up to $6 million? This one family in the allegation paid over $6 million to get their child into an Ivy League school. And I'm thinking to myself, if you knock on the door of Harvard University and say, "Hi, I'm rich. I'd like to write you a $6 million check on the slight condition, wink, wink, that you admit Junior here into your school." I'm going to tell you, I think Harvard's going to jump on that. They have. Historically, it's been known to happen. But that's an above board transaction and not one necessarily that can be prosecuted. The allegation here, of course, is that these parents had through this guy here in Newport, our very own Newport Beach. We had a guy named Rick Singer who was a guidance counselor, essentially, but he was hiring people to sit in exams and change answers. And, you know, you've heard the story. I mean, you know what's been going on. And in all of this, the overwhelming impression or the thought that I have in this is that this is a classic case of short-cutted parenting. And what I mean by this is these parents, right, living their Hollywood dreams and high-flying lifestyles, and they're busy, you know, mouthing off on every political situation, talking about how, again, all getting involved in every social issue and saving the planet and hugging trees and being vegan and all this stuff, don't have the time to sit down and read, for Pete's sake, read with their kids. No, these kids get everything handed to them. They get all the permissive of the modern parenting, you know, spare the rod. And these kids, I mean, these kids are not naturally stupid. I don't think that's the problem. I mean, there's obviously you're born with a certain amount of intelligence. And some people, sadly, are born with less of it than others. But these children probably needed parents who were going to sit over them as they did their homework and kick them in the money and tell them to work hard. Hey, girl, stop YouTubing. Stop Instagramming. And why don't you do some practice SATs? Why don't you read a freaking book? And these kids, instead of reading books and being told to do their homework and to do their chores and build the kind of discipline personally that would lead to academic success, just loafed around, played video games, had parents who were probably, for the most part, largely absentee. And the result of it then is, when pressed up against the clock, what did these parents do? Guilt set in. They realized that they, you know, had failed their kids in some substantial way and risked these type of legal consequences to make up for whatever they didn't do for their children in the lead up to all of this. Now, I realize that, you know, am I reading too much into this? No, I'm not. Look, I live in Irvine. I'm going to tell you right now what certain cultures that we have a lot of in Irvine do for the success of their kids. And spoiler alert, I admire it. These are parents who literally have no life. They literally do not go out. They don't have friends. They don't go on dates on the weekend. Their entire lives are their children's academic success. And I remember growing up myself, you know, and, you know, this is something that European culture and Asian culture has shares a similarity with. What my parents sacrificed of their enjoyment, of their personal lives, to stand over me, to make sure I did my homework, that they read with me, they corrected my work. I mean, this is labor intensive. And that is what you are supposed to do as a parent, and not cut corners in the moments, literally the moments leading up to you applying for college. So I'm fascinated by this case, not necessarily, and this may surprise you, not necessarily from the legal aspect of it, because I mean it's actually an interesting novel theory here. I mean, not novel, but it's an aggressive prosecution, in my view. You know, it It is. I think that it's the prosecutors here are going after people because they want to make a big case out of it. They like this. This is a this entire case has political overtones to it that that prosecutors like. They like going after rich people buying access. And I suspect that the defense of these parents are, hey, we're just, this is how you do it. I didn't know all the details. I didn't know what was going on. I was told to donate. It looked like a credible charity. It seemed like a thing that people are doing. I know that people donate money to schools to get their children in. This is a common practice. Fully expect some of these charges to get reduced and to get dropped and to not be as a big of a deal down the road as they seem to be right now. But the real story is parenting in the 21st century, and especially, oddly enough, it's the people that are quick to talk about the village raising a child, and they can't even get their own damn house in order. Frustrating. All right. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. More about this coming right up.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
You can't, you can't even predict how stupid Elizabeth Warren is. You can try. You can wake up in the morning like I do pretty much every day and think, what stupid thing is Elizabeth Warren going to do today? And given that she's trying to maintain a high visibility profile with her, ill-fated presidential campaign underway, she gives us plenty of opportunities for this. One came in response to this college cheating scandal. And here she is speaking with Mika Brzezinski from Joe and Mika, Morning Joe, whatever the hell that show is called. And Mika is asking her a question about the scandal and the irony. I mean, it's like there is no awareness of how ironic the question is. Play the tape, Robbie.
You're one of the few candidates with a really significant, clear message that you have lived throughout your life. So I want to ask you some questions about other issues that you would confront as president. Rapid fire.
Okay.
So just your gut on these core things. So as a parent, how much sympathy would you have for these parents who are embroiled in this alleged cheating scandal?
Zero.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me? Elizabeth Cherokee Warren, who used illicitly, might I add, illegally, but an absolute multicultural fraud, scientifically proven fraud, might I add, used it to get into school, used it to get positions in academia, and she is condemning, right, these parents who have paid money to give their kids a leg up in the same process where she cheated to get a leg up. It's unbelievable. And it does raise another point here, where in the overall kind of gut check of equities, right, because Mika Brzezinski's asking Warren for a gut check. So I will carry on here. And help Mika out in a gut check about the equity of all of this. Isn't there really a lot of cheating in general, when it comes to college applications? Now, what do I mean by that? This entire problem, right? This entire scandal is framed as an issue caused by, right? There's people that are deserving of these slots in these schools, but were cheated out of them by virtue of what Felicity Huffman did for her daughter, right? And I would say, isn't this the same thing that we have going on with affirmative action? In other words, we are giving a leg up to somebody not because of their qualifications, but because of their victim status. And it's a victim status that, by the way, is you don't just drop on the earth and God give you a victim number, right? You don't get a ranking. What you do is you've got to make a pitch for your victim status, right? That's what you do as a candidate. And certain candidates play it up more than others. And those candidates that do get a leg up. Now, I'm not saying it's illegal, but is it ethical? And so I see this, you know, I see a lot of, it's so funny. The left, there's a great piece in The Guardian. The left is going bananas right now, saying that meritocracy is dead. Man, meritocracy is a myth. Meritocracy is this invention, right? I'm just paraphrasing here. Is an invention that the elites have made to assuage their guilt for the leg up that they got. No. I didn't get a lie. We are a merit-based system. Now, that's the story, and I'm going to stick with it because if it weren't a merit-based system, well, then I would have success guilt. Now, I think that this part of the story is where it all gets really interesting because it goes to the heart of who we are as a country, as a system, as a political, a socio-political system, and where we need to be moving forward. And I think it has everything to do with affirmative action. And I will explain that. I'll explain it because I got to give this some time. So when we come back, let me get into this. Because I think we are ready for some change. I think that we are entering a post-affirmative action era. We're ready for it as a country. But the left, here's a spoiler alert, the left does not want it, and I will explain that. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Rogowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network, fighting dilatory obfuscation one issue at a time. All right. Yes, I promised the piece in The Guardian about this. Nathan Robinson, left-wing commie pinko. The piece is titled, Meritocracy is a Myth Invented by the Rich. There's a great quote in here. It's simple. Wealth always confers greater capacity to give your children the edge over other people's children. Yes, that's true. He adds, if we wanted anything resembling a meritocracy, we would probably have to start by instituting full egalitarian communism. It doesn't matter what system you have. There is always power and privilege concentrated in the hands of a few. And actually, by the way, Nathan, let me explain something to you about communism. In communism, that power is concentrated in the hands of far fewer people than in a system like we have here, you know, capitalism, where a great number of people are successful. By more so by their own doing and by their own accomplishment than by some standing that they have within a political structure. So I bring that up. And by the way, in communism, I can speak to this authoritatively with my parents' upbringing in the 50s in communist Czechoslovakia. you didn't get to go to school if you're politically undesirable. You didn't go. And your academic prowess had really very little to do with your academic future. What mattered was your political standing, the political standing of your family, really, and whether you had a good political report card. And it's this system, friends, this system, this loathsome system that rewards people not based on their ability, not based on their accomplishments, but rather on their political worthiness that was transplanted literally from the Bolshevik East into our system, college system here in the West in the form of affirmative action, where it is the political worth of an applicant that is determined by the amount or the strength of their victimhood. And it's being exploited, right? Who is it being exploited by? It's being exploited by the political classes because it makes them feel good. So what you have, you've got institutions of higher learning, august organizations built upon, you know, bright shining cities on a hill, blah, 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 right? Ivory tower institutions. And they pat themselves on their backs and say, oh, good job, Cornelius. I don't know. I made up a name. But good job. Good job. We are helping the underprivileged. We are, thanks to us, we are righting wrongs and making things. And this is how they think. This is how they talk amongst themselves. And I'll tell you, this guy here, this piece in the Guardian, he has no idea. There's another great line here. We can imagine a different world, one that is different from the competitive college system that we have. If everyone was guaranteed, this is a direct quote, if everyone was guaranteed free, high-quality public university education and a public school education matched the quality of private school education, there wouldn't be anything to compete for. And he's saying that's a good thing. Now, let me tell you, in Europe, you have high quality public education. You do. We have it here, too. But in Europe, really, I mean, you can go to a top school, like, let's say, in Prague, Charles University, the oldest university in Central Europe. And you can go there. And it costs you bupkis nothing. I mean, I don't know what tuition is. 3 shekels and a mule. I don't really know. I don't know. I mean, it's I think $200 or something a year. I mean, a very, very, very small amount of money. But it's impossible to get in by virtue of it being a top school. They can't let in everybody. They have standards. And they have limited number of spots. And you know what else in Europe? And I hate to break it to all these left-wing nutsos here in the U.S. that worship European socialism as if it was, you know, God's greatest gift. But in Europe, about 13, maybe 14, they look at you as a student and go, you know what? You're dumber than a bag of hammers and you don't belong in college. And they say, you know what you're going to be? You're going to be a mechanic. You know what you're going to be? You're going to be a baker or a candlestick maker. They're going to, I'll tell you what you sure as hell are not going to be as a professional. If you think I'm joking about any of this, you're dead wrong. Our system here in America is so great because it allows for people to get a second chance. And I would never, if I was raised in Europe, I would have, if I had been raised in Europe and had the and took the path that I took here, where I ended up going to law school as a 31-year-old, I mean, that's unheard of over there. Forget it. Your lot in life is figured out by the time you're 14. Because you're either going to a pre-college, right, pre-university, high school, or you're going to a trade school, or you're going to a technical school that where you might, you know, eventually become an engineer and, you know, and have no interpersonal skills. So, I mean, that's the setup. And our system here, these stupid, self-loathing American liberals have their heads so far up their asses. I know I said the word. I'm sorry. A-money monies, Daniel, in case you're listening. So, yeah, on that note, by the way, I'll tell you when we come back, let me tell you my experience of going, because I, as a 31-year-old, was applying to law schools. It was a traumatizing experience. And I had my own brush with a singer type situation. Let me share that with you. I won't name the school. It's not Chapman. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rejofsky back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Yo, Sam Rejofsky, college student reporting for duty. I'm 31 years old, and I finished 2 years of undergrad. And, I got to back up the story a little bit. So, you know, I went to college at 18 or 17, right? Right after high school. And I start college. And I hated it. I wanted to work. I wanted to make money. I wanted to be, you know, I don't know. My head was in everything other than school. And so as soon as I began working, and at 21, I want to say I got a significant full-time job opportunity where I was making more money than any of my friends that were graduating from college. I took it and I bailed on school. And so I had to go back at 29. Some of you have maybe heard me talk about the story, but at 29, I decided, okay, I got to get my life together and I need to attend law school. But I had to finish first my undergraduate degree. And my GPA from the time I was an 18 to 20-year-old was atrocious. I mean, I think I could have had an amoeba take my tests, and I would have ended up with a similar GPA. So, anyway, I come back now as an adult learner with two kids. I had Vera. We had Vera when I was finishing my undergraduate degree. So I'm a father. I'm working. I'm a professional. And I got straight A's because I was focused on the task at hand. So I have this great GPA from as an adult. And then 7 years earlier, I had this really bad GPA. And when you average the two together, it was okay. It was like a 3.5 GPA, cumulative GPA. And my LSAT was okay. Not great, not bad. I didn't have anyone taking the test for me or correcting my answers. That's my bad. I should have done that, clearly. So anyway, so I, with these scores, I now am applying to various schools. And I mean, it was brutal. It was terrible. And I thought that I had this great, you know, resume, this great thing. You know, I'm a grown up. I'm going to hit the ground running as an alumnus of the school, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be doing all these great things and blah, blah, blah. And I quickly found out that as far as graduate schools, and parents, listen to me, this is important. You got a kid going to college. I'm going to tell you right now, here's what the school cares about. 49% of it is, for example, in law school. This is very true for law schools. 49% GPA, 49% LSAT, 2% your kid's shining rock star personality, okay? Essentially, the essays and all that stuff, all that hard work that you put into your application and the heart, your heart that you pour out onto the page, is really there for tie-breaking decisions. Okay? They've got student A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, right? All these students lined up, and they all have the same exact numbers. Tie-breaking. What do we do? Okay, let's now look at their personal statement. And it was brutal. It was just brutal, and I wasn't getting it anywhere. But I was already working in a law firm, and, you know, there was money involved, and this firm got approached. My firm was approached by a top 20 law school. And I'm not gonna name the institution. $100,000 would have bought my way into a top 20 school. So, by the way, I have no idea what the hell these parents were doing paying Rick Singer $6 million. The amateur hour, right? And but I'll tell you, for me, I was as grossed out as I possibly could be. And I intuitively knew that I would not be okay with that. You know, if I was talking to you now and saying, well, I went to so-and-so of his law school, and blah, 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 this is so great, you know, pat myself on the back. And in the back of my mind would be this tremendous compromise. So instead, I had to wait to get ignominiously denied by Chapman Law. I don't know if you remember this part of the story. I got denied because of just a crazy, insane head of admissions back then. She's no longer there. This woman was awful. And I was on the wait list, and then she kicked me off the wait list, which I don't think ever happened. I think she just didn't like me. I think she sensed my white privilege and found it repulsive. So anyway, I then had to lawyer my way into the school, and I wrote them a letter, and that's for another time. But I ended up getting accepted through my own hard work and my own hustle, and I'm proud of that. But even then, I remember showing up at orientation, and I felt like I didn't belong. I felt like I wasn't entitled to be there because I had been originally rejected by the school. And so a great deal of my love for Chapman actually comes from the chance that they took on me and the opportunity that they gave me. And they are an absolutely phenomenal institution that I care about deeply. So that's the story. This shortcut business to success is as old as time. But remember, the left is all about these shortcuts. They have been. And they've been creating them on the basis of disability, on the basis of skin color, on the basis of background for decades now. And so why wouldn't a few wealthy libs cheat to get their kids into school? How is their moral compromise any different
on the show tonight than the
Sam institutionalized racism
now what Sam is,
and advantages
is the leading
that have been
word
given out by universities
in correct
for
thinking.
Answer.
As
not.
Opposed to Ed, which is
but
drunk thinking.
It because it's not who
and
we
it's
are.
Usually
Sam
where
Rzowski
the left ends
right
up on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rzowski, Sam Nation, yes. Let's. I want to get into this Boeing crash, because you know, obviously, you know, all things aviation interest me and fascinate me profoundly. I could not presume to speak authoritatively about the subject. So what I've decided to do for you all is bring Jim Eliason, who is patiently holding. For us as we speak, patiently holding to come on the show here via telephone and give some remarks about this in his view. Jim is one of the best pilots I know, and I know quite a few pilots. And I know, well, we've had him on the program before. You guys know Jim. He's a big leftist, but we love him dearly. And really very knowledgeable. So I want to get the skinny on this crash, because there's a lot more to this story than meets the eye. So this interview, we may go a little bit long here, this next segment. Just be patient with us, because you, by the end of this, I think will know a lot more about what's cooking than you did before. Okay, we'll be back right after this with Jim Eliason, pilot extraordinaire on the Sam Nation show here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. And as promised, a special guest to discuss a topic that is very much in the news and on everybody's mind. On the phone here to us in the studio is Jim Eliason. Jim, as you guys know, you've heard him before here on the program, a phenomenal pilot and expert in all things aviation. And so, Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, I want to talk to you about this this Boeing fiasco. I have some thoughts on it, and I thought you probably have some thoughts on it yourself.
Oh yes.
So the world is panicking, and
yeah,
you got these airplanes out there that are, and I'll just we'll start first. I'll humor you, and I'll tell you what I think I know about this, and then
okay.
And then you can laugh at me and point out all the things that I don't know about this. So here's my understanding of this. The 737, the Boeing 737, is the most reliable workhorse of all the Boeing planes I think ever made. It's out there. It's one of the most common type of equipment used for you and I when we fly the airlines. And my understanding is that they've come out in maybe the last 3 or 4 years with this new iteration of this plane called the 737 MAX, and it comes in different variations. But these versions, what I understand about them is that they're, in a lot of ways, they're substantially different from the old original planes. The position of the engines is in a little bit of a different place, and they've got some new equipment that helps compensate for those engines being in a different place. I guess this is how I understand it. So there's been these two big crashes, one in Indonesia, and then now we had one last week in Ethiopia, and both of them supposedly have or share some similar characteristics. And so now people are panicking. The whole world, I think every country now, has grounded its 737 MAX fleet, and this is, I'm assuming, hugely disruptive, because for a number of airlines here in the U.S., this plane has been covering a lot of important routes. So how close am I to understanding the broad strokes of this?
I think that's right on.
Oh.
That's exactly what's going on. It's a new iteration of a trusted and valuable workhorse, and it has a new system in it. That basically makes up for the differences in handling between the new iteration and the old iterations because of where they place the engines mostly, and the effect that has in certain regimes of certain flying regimes. So,
I think
it's been well enough covered that most people, I think, actually understand that correctly.
Well, so all right. So now, is the plane inherently unsafe?
No, I don't think so. I think there is an unsafe condition, which is exactly what the FAA has said since November. Just to go through this real quick, there have been as everybody knows now, there have been a number of MAX 8, at least. I don't know about the MAX 9, but the MAX 8, there have been a number of pilots that have complained about similar issues. Now, it could be that those issues were not as drastic as the ones that happened to the two accident airplanes.
Right.
It could be that maybe the guys that had the original issues managed to figure out how to stop it.
And the issue is, just not to interrupt, but so people understand, the issue, I think, is that the plane is going up, you know, and trying to climb, and then suddenly which doesn't sound like a good thing to me, the nose suddenly begins to pitch downward, and there's some struggle in regaining altitude with the plane. Is that basically what's going on?
What happens with this system, the MCAS system, this system is... what happens with the new placement of these engines is when the airplane is in a nose high attitude, when it's climbing very steeply, it tends to pitch up more so than the legacy 737s do.
Okay.
And so they determined that when they were doing testing on this airplane, probably very early on in the wind tunnel phases. And so they developed this MCAS system. It's maneuvering characteristics augmentation system, and it does exactly what the name says, which is that it attempts to make the new iteration, the MAX airplanes, act as if they are the older legacy 737s. So those airplanes did not have this tendency to pitch up when they were already at high angles of attack or high, you know, nose high angles. So they put this system into the airplane to intentionally keep the nose from going up too far. So to counteract that tendency for the nose to pitch up when it's already at high angles of attack. So that's what's at the crux of the problem.
And is the system this system, right? It's supposed to make everything work just fine, right? And it's supposed to make the plane behave completely normally. Wherein lies the problem?
Well, because this airplane is not the same, does not have the same characteristics, and so whenever you try to fix, artificially fix the characteristics by putting another system on board to, you know, artificially do something about the problem, you introduce potential other problems.
It's overcorrecting. Is that what you could say?
The problem is that system has to get its inputs from somewhere. So it needs to know when to kick in. And if the inputs that it gets are erroneous, then it will kick in when it's not supposed to kick in, or it will kick in too much or too often. And that seems to be what's happening from everything that Boeing has said, from everything that the FAA has said, that seems to be, and from what the pilots have said, that seems to be what's happening. So they had the accident airplane, the Lion Air accident airplane, the one that happened in October, that very airplane had similar problems on the flight the night before. So as they were bringing that airplane in to where it left from, it had what they called a roller coaster flight. So it traumatized many of the passengers that were on that flight, because it was apparently pretty unusual. That airplane also, according to the logbooks, that had an unspecified nav failure, navigation failure, and an airspeed indicator failure. Now, those things have nothing to do, or shouldn't have anything to do, with the MCAS system, but perhaps they do. There's a lot of inputs to these systems that they make because, for whatever reason, and pilots don't necessarily know why, but the airspeed indicator and the angle of attack indicator shouldn't have anything to do with each other. But that airplane had problems coming in, and then the next day when it left, it had at least similar problems, and it crashed. And that was on October 29th. Now, the investigation into that airplane led to they revealed what's called an angle of attack indicator fault, or an AOA fault. Angle of attack indicators, most jets have, that basically indicate your angle of attack. And when the angle of attack gets too high, that's a bad thing. So that's what this MCAS system is supposed to mitigate. So
is it a, I mean, I'm looking at it and I'm listening to this. I'm thinking, so it is this something that can be, is it augmented by training? I mean, do you train these pilots that are flying
these MAX models? It should be. See, that's the rub. Now, the AOA in that airplane had been replaced because they knew that there was something wrong with it, so they replaced it, but it had the same problem after they replaced it. So
what's the AOA?
The AOA is the angle of attack indicator, and most jets have them, and they literally show you your angle of attack. So if your angle of attack gets too great, you're in danger of stalling, and that's what the MCAS system was put in there to mitigate. So if the angle of attack gets too high, the MCAS system kicks in, and it starts to push the nose of the airplane down by trimming the nose of the airplane.
Right.
By trimming the tail. So the nose of the airplane comes down. So they had angle of attack problems on a number of these airplanes. And I don't know whether it's a bad design of the angle of attack indicator in those airplanes or whether it's something else in the software, because they replaced angle of attack indicators and still had the same problems.
Sounds like the
FAA, and here's the critical part.
Okay.
That accident happened on October 29th. On November 7th, just barely a week later, the FAA put out what's called an AD. That's an airworthiness directive. ADs are very serious, and they are put out to because of a safety issue. So the FAA put out AD 2018-23-51, which I'm actually looking at right now. It's 4.5 pages. And it was issued, in their words, and I quote, "for an unsafe condition likely to exist or develop in other products of the same type design," which means other MAX airplanes. And, quoting, "the need to correct an urgent safety of flight situation." So the FAA understood, after looking at the data from that Lion Air crash, that there wasn't potentially unsafe condition that needed to be addressed. And that's how they address unsafe conditions. They put out an AD. These are mandatory instructions from the FAA to operators of that, whatever that airplane is, that tell you what you should be doing. And in this AD, which is not much talked about for some reason, this AD talks about the problem. It tells you what to do and what procedures to follow, and it mandates that you give that information to all the operators, all the pilots.
Right.
And so everybody should have known about that now. And so what that does basically is it gives you a path. First of all, it tells you that there's a problem other than what you might think the problem is, because apparently part of the dark side of the story is that the pilots didn't know about this new MCAS system.
Why is that?
Pilots at American, the pilots at United.
Don't you train? I'm sorry to jump in, but just so people understand, don't you train when you become a new pilot or a newly certified pilot on a new airplane? Right? You train on a simulator, and don't you use that type of equipment on the simulator during your training?
Yes.
But
what would have happened with this particular, with the MAX airplanes, is since they were an iteration of the 737, pilots would have put them into the fleet, and the pilots that were already flying 737s would have been put into those airplanes. And so before they do that, they will go through something called differences training, which is a shorter course, because the airplane is essentially the same. It has many of the same systems, and it's very familiar to them because it is an iteration of an older model that they've been flying and they have experience with. But you're always supposed to go to a differences training. It's required, mandated to go to differences training, so that you can understand any of the peculiarities of the new version. Apparently, the MCAS system was left out of the training. Now, all of the pilots have said that. Boeing has all but admitted that. And so that's the weak point, is that Boeing knew that it had this MCAS system in there. And actually, the Wall Street Journal did a piece back in November, I believe it was, where it stated that, let me see if I can find the quote here, because this is really interesting, that Boeing had, quote, decided against disclosing more details to cockpit crews due to concerns about inundating average pilots with too much information, unquote.
Oh, my gosh. So the problem is average pilots.
Well, no, it's not. They didn't mean it that way. They meant.
Well, Jim, I'm not talking about you. You're an extraordinary pilot. But
I'm an extraordinarily bad pilot. But
hogwash.
But yeah. But now it's unclear to me what that what exactly that means, but it seems to mean, because the pilots did not know that the MCAS system was even in there. Now, you don't have to know exactly how the algorithms work, and you don't even want to know that stuff, but you do need to know that there's a system in there that's supposed to do X, Y, and Z. And you need to understand, like, where's the circuit breaker? Where's the switch? How can I turn it on? How can I turn it off? What's it supposed to be doing?
Well, yeah, when it's shoving your nose,
you can't troubleshoot it.
Right, or you can't shut it off if it's misdirecting the airplane and the human being in the cockpit is being overruled by a machine, right? I think that's
right.
Potentially what's happening.
Well, if you don't know it's there, then you don't even know what you're supposed to be turning off.
Correct.
So, yeah. So it's a problem that you can't even troubleshoot the problem.
But I'll tell you, I mean, I just you know, a part of the story. It's funny you bring this story up from the what the Washington Wall Street Journal said or wrote there. I know that standards, and you and I have had this conversation a number of times, standards have been dropping in a sense for pilots as there have been as the need, the demand for pilots has exceeded supply. And so I know this from my own experience in the industry that there are a lot of very junior people that are going into the going to the airlines now. And maybe that's part of the story. I mean, I know the pilot that perished in the crash in Ethiopia is being heralded as a highly experienced pilot. But if his experience was, 8,000 hours, of which, 3,000 most recent hours were in a 737, a standard 737, and only barely began flying on one of these new MAX planes and hadn't been trained properly, I mean, now you're not talking about a veteran aviator and not certainly not somebody who's been prepared for this type of in-flight emergency. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, all of that is possible, and it's we'll know more about that as they do the full investigation. It's certainly true that not very many people had much time in this airplane because it's a brand new type of airplane. So the MAXes are only a couple of years old. And they probably didn't start having problems with this MCAS system right away. That was probably something that took a year or so for the bugs to start showing up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
More interesting to me is that these guys didn't seem to know about this AD that was put out, because normally the ADs, now sometime in November on their own, Boeing decided that they were going to do a software fix. And so they were working on the software fix. And what happened in January, as we all know, is that we had a 5-week shutdown of the government. And so that 5-week government shutdown delayed the approval and implementation of that software fix by at least the 5 weeks, probably closer to 6 or 7.
Trump's fault.
So it's.
There we go.
Well,
we figured it out.
I'm blaming it on the government Trump shutdown, without, whoever you think it might be responsible for it. That shutdown unquestionably stopped the approval and implementation process. And so it's possible that if they had gotten the software done in that time, that it might have alleviated that problem.
Yeah, so
but the AD itself, if they'd known about that and they'd had that instruction, they should have known how to turn it off. So that's a question in my mind. I have probably more questions about this than you do, because I just, my mind reels with, like, what were these guys going through, and what did they know and what did they not know? What did they try?
Right.
It's not, as has been widely reported, an autopilot problem. You can't just turn the autopilot off and the problem goes away. This system works with or without the autopilot.
Understood.
So that's according to the AD. So
right.
one of the items that they list in the AD is, if you're having a stabilizer, uncommanded movement of the stabilizer, and the autopilot won't engage, that's one of the things that they point out, that this is when you need to exercise this technique that they're giving you. So,
well,
I don't know why they didn't know, or maybe they did and they didn't remember. Those are the questions I have.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Now that every plane has been grounded, what next? I mean, how they're not gonna, this grounding isn't going to, and it cannot last forever. So what's going on, in your best guess, behind the scenes? How does this, what's Boeing doing? What's the FAA doing? What are the airlines doing? And what does this mean for us?
Well, what's going on now, and the FAA has already said that it will probably be at least April before the airplanes come back up. And,
wow.
And what they're doing is that they're trying to get full approval and implementation of the software that Boeing started working on back in November. That's what's going to get the airplanes back in the air. When the airplanes get this new software in them, it probably requires some rewiring, because what they're going to do is right now the MCAS system gets its information from that angle of attack indicator that we talked about.
Right.
That's the only instrument, according to the FAA and Boeing, that system uses. So if the angle of attack indicator is not working properly, then the system won't work properly. So part of the software fix is to add other inputs so that it's not so reliant on one. And this was, by the way, according to another report that was done, there were Boeing engineers that worked on that MCAS system who had expressed concern about the AOA being a single point of failure problem. So that's what they're trying to fix now. They're trying to get this new software in these airplanes. It's going to take some time. It will likely take some rewiring. And once that's done, in conjunction with the AD that's already out there, then the airplanes will start flying again. So,
well,
that's,
I'll tell you,
what's going to solve it.
My prediction is that before these airplanes even begin to take flight, the lawsuits are going to get filed. Because
the lawsuits have already been filed.
There
I
it
mean,
is.
Everybody's filing lawsuits.
Yeah, this
against
is
everybody.
Yeah, because I think, yeah, especially if there is. This kind of dumbing down behind the scenes, I imagine any attorney worth his or her salt who practices this type of law will be all over this. Oh my goodness. Well, all right. So once
for my, just to close, I can say a few words in defense of any of the parties, but I really and I love Boeing products, but they have really, in my view, behaved badly here. And they were lobbying to keep the airplanes in the air right up until the day that it happened. And then when they knew that they couldn't stop it, they put out a statement. If you read through their statements, it's entertaining and kind of sad, but they put out a statement saying that they had recommended to the FAA that they ground the fleet, even though all week long they had been lobbying in the media,
right,
and in their own statements and with the pilots unions. And, you know, they even, Muhlenberg even called the White House the day before the grounding,
yeah,
to plead his case. And then when they couldn't stop it, they put out a statement that said that they had recommended the grounding, which, you know, I just think that they've behaved abysmally here, and they could do a lot better. And I understand that there's legal issues that they're trying to avoid, but I think that they're just burying themselves by being overcautious about this.
Well, it's always the cover up, right? That's worse,
right.
Worse than anything else.
Exactly.
Well, this has been
what pisses people off.
Yeah, beyond a doubt.
It's not like we understand they didn't intentionally put a system in there that they thought was going to be a safety hazard. That's not what happened.
I think my guess is the software isn't it made by Microsoft? Who does the, or is it a Boeing? Because it's like either Microsoft or Android. It just, I'm being snarky. Well, I'm being snarky. I
have no idea. I assume it's Boeing software.
Here's, and this is interesting to me because this goes to the very root of my fear of driverless technology in cars. Because I buy this, and I'm an Apple guy. I know you're a, you're the other type of phone guy, so I tease you about
that.
You're the other guy. But even my $1,000 iPhone, how many times do I have to just shut it down and restart it when it hits a glitch? But, you know, the worst thing that happens to me in a glitch with my iPhone is that I lose a call or I have to wait a few minutes to get my emails or my texts. But what happens when you have to reboot your car that's hurtling down the freeway, you know, at 65 miles an hour with no steering wheel, no brake pedal, no gas, nothing. And you're having to rely on the software. And my point in all of this is that a car can't cost more than, let's say, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 to make it affordable for even wealthy Americans, right? And these Boeing MAX planes average $100 million. And so the amount of technology that Boeing is able to load into these planes and the amount of R&D dollars that they're able to load into it is so enormous, right? And yet they still, even in those conditions, can't get it right. And the technology essentially can be too clever by half, causing this kind of substantial loss of life. So I think that the carryover to driverless technology that a lot of people are thinking about, is real. I always say the tech doesn't work great in these $100 million pieces of equipment. How's it going to work on a $35,000-$38,000 Honda? It's just, I don't.
Well, I think the biggest sin on Boeing's part was that they didn't make it clear to pilots that there was this system in the airplane. You've got to tell guys what's in the airplane. They don't have to understand exactly how it works. They don't need to know the software, but they need to know it's in the airplane and it's going to do this. And that way, if it acts up, they know how to turn it off. This AD was supposed to solve that problem. And for some reason, not everybody got the message, I guess. I don't know. That's still to be determined. But that, I think, is the biggest, that's the biggest flaw here, is that they sold this airplane to the airlines on a minimal training basis. That was part of their sales pitch. So
totally.
I think it had more to do with that than anything else, that, hey, this is going to be just like all the other 737s that you're already flying. It's going to take minimal time for you to upgrade your guys to it. They're already flying a 737. And I think it seems to me like that they had that in mind more than anything else in not telling pilots that this system was in the airplane. And I think that's the greatest sin here. So that's my version of it.
Got it. Well, Jim, thank you for your insight here. Always great to have you on the program. And I know that was the longest segment in Sam Nation history, but I think a very comprehensive view of everything that's going on. And now, you know, we all can be a little better informed and know what's cooking behind the scenes, which is always the aim of this program. Jim, thank you. Thanks
for talking to you, Sam. I would just like to say very briefly that I'm just bringing myself up to speed on this New Zealand, horrific New Zealand events. And my thoughts are going out to all of those people over there.
Yeah, we've talked about it here. Yeah, it's awful. It's just awful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jim.
Always good to talk to you, though, Sam. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim. Take care. Bye. All right. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. More about this coming right up.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network, making radio great again. By the way, I forgot to tease Jim about the slogan. Do you guys know the slogan? If it ain't Boeing, I'm not going. You heard that slogan? And it comes, I've had people tell me, you know, that Airbus is crap. And it, you know, it's made in France. I've never had a French car, but I know a few people who've lived to regret making that decision once or twice. So anyway, the Airbuses were made in France, very software heavy. And Boeing was always this company that prided itself on putting in extra rivets, having the planes be very solid, and also having having more of a pilot's feel for the way that they operate. So this, of course, is a huge black eye for them, as Jim explained. Now, speaking of black eyes, embarrassments, if you will, we have one in Congress. Her name is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I think, you know that that MCAS system, how it's glitchy on the Boeing, on the airplane. Well, sometimes AOC software glitches a little bit too. And, well, I'll play you the, do you have the black box, Robbie? We're going to play the black box because here is AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, questioning the CEO of Wells Fargo in her capacity as a member of the Financial Services Committee. Yes, 28 years old. On the Financial Services Committee. She is a child. I know she's got her skills. I get it. But she is a child in life. Questioning the CEO of Wells Fargo. And it does not go well. Here is the exchange.
Mr. Sloan, why was the bank involved in the caging of children and financing the caging of children to begin with?
I don't know how to answer that question because we weren't.
So in finance... You were financing and involved in debt financing of CoreCivic and Geo Group, correct?
For a period of time, we were involved in financing one of the firms. We're not anymore, and the other. I'm not familiar with the specific assertion that you're making, but we weren't directly involved in that.
Okay. So these companies run private detention facilities run by ICE, which is involved in caging children. But I'll move on.
This is the equivalent of what Jim was talking about. This is a stall. Wow, we're going down. God, she was looking around for a parachute, I bet. You know what's going on here? What's going on is it all sounds good when these cute kids are talking amongst themselves. Oh, yes, this, you know, Wells Fargo is caging children. They are financing. They provided a line of credit to a company who runs some detention facilities that we are accusing have, you know, systematically caged children for no good reason. And they all sit amongst themselves in their you know, at the Starbucks there, by Capitol Hill, yucking it up because it all sounds so good when they're saying it to themselves, and suddenly. You can hear how her own stupidity is coming out, and she's running out of runway. For me to just, pardon me, extending the aviation metaphor just one last time. Play it one more time. Play this one more time. Just listen to this. Epic.
Mr. Sloan, why was the bank involved in the caging of children and financing the caging of children to begin with?
I don't know how to answer that question because we weren't.
So in finance, you were financing and involved in debt financing of CoreCivic and Geo.
I mean, that's really what's going on. It's epic fail. So yeah, so sometimes the AOC software doesn't load fully or it glitches. The angle of attack indicator perhaps is busted. Yes. Madam, your angle of attack here failed spectacularly. Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Producer Robbie makes an excellent point. Since we've heard ad nauseum that AOC was a bartender for a number of years, that's how she made her ends, financial ends meet. And by the way, props to her. Look, I mean, that's not a point of contention. But what producer Robbie had a great point here. Was AOC at any point in her bartending career complicit in domestic violence? Because presumably she served a drink to some guy or gal who then went home and got a little aggressive with his or her domestic partner. I mean, that's the logic when you're attacking a bank for lending money to a group that, you know, that then assists the government. I mean, this is pretty far removed. Unbelievable. Well, I'll tell you what, the Democrats have a solution for this youthful stupidity, and that is we need more young idiots in our political system. Nancy Pelosi here on the voting age being lowered to 16. Yes, 16. You heard me right.
As far as 16-year-olds voting, where do you see that going into the future?
Personally, I'm not speaking for my caucus. I myself have always been for lowering the voting age to 16. I think it's really important to capture kids when they're in high school, when they're interested in all of this, when they're learning about government, to be able to vote. That's a subject of debate. But my view is that I would welcome that. But I've been in that position for a long time.
Well, I got to tell you something. For those of us who are parents, I don't have a 16-year-old. I've got an 11-year-old, and I think the world of him. And I suspect that in 5 years he is going to be a fine young man. But I suspect that as far as life is concerned, he's still going to be a little bit of an idiot. Hell, I think at 18, I'm blown away by this. No, you may not drink until 21 because you lack the judgment. You lack the judgment to drink responsibly. But by all means, let's lower the voting age to 16. And I would say this, too. Doesn't it worry you, or doesn't it speak volumes about a certain party, a certain political group, the Democrats, that their political strategy is they're the ones that want the kids voting. The Democrats want more idiots in the voting pool because that's how they're going to maintain power. Everything you need to know about the ridiculousness of the Democratic Party platform is in what Nancy Pelosi just said. So that's fun stuff. Now, I want to talk about Brexit for a minute here. We'll close the program with that because there's a lot that's happened, and I want to make sure that on this side of the pond, we understand what this is all about. Sam Rzhovsky, back right after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation. All right, Brexit. What's going on with Brexit? Is it irretrievably lost? Will we have a Brexit? Let's look into the crystal ball. So, Theresa May has absolutely screwed this thing up from top to bottom. And I'll tell you, she is screwing it up by design. Theresa May became prime minister of Great Britain, replacing David Cameron when David Cameron stepped down because he was on the side of anti-Brexit. And when Brexit passed, David Cameron did the sensible thing, had lost a mandate, if you will, to be prime minister, to lead this process, and said candidly, I am not the person to lead our country through Brexit because I don't believe in it. But the British Parliament, being the wet noodles that they are, instead of electing a guy like Boris Johnson, prominent pro-Brexit leader, decided to bring in Theresa May, who is a Remainer in her heart. She doesn't want Brexit. And so she, in a remarkably, and I don't think it was a stupid move, I think she did this on purpose. First, she deliberately loads up a basically an anti-Brexit move, pro-Brexit bill that she wants to stay, but wants to get out. So she loads it up with all sorts of things that are a poison pill to the pro-Brexit people. It fails. And then there's a second vote. And the vote, the most important thing, this was 2 days ago. This vote had to do with leaving with a deal or with no deal. Now, this is really critical. The pro-Brexit people, right? Among them, there are two camps. There's one camp that's okay leaving the EU without a deal with the EU. Basically, here's two middle fingers to Europe. We're out of here and we're going to sort this thing out. We're going to rip the Band-Aid off and make it work. And the second part of it is like, we want Brexit, but we want to work out a deal. We want to be friends with Europe. We want to kiss European hiney. And those people are messing this whole thing up. Because how do you negotiate a deal with someone and at the same time vote to say that there's no way we're going to leave without a deal? This is like negotiating 101. Hi, I'm here to buy a car. And by the way, let me tell you, my family, we've just voted and we are 100% leaving with a car today. But I can't tell you that. No, I just did. I told you we're buying a car. Now let's negotiate on the price. What the F? You go to a car dealership and say, you know what? Screw you. I'm not buying this car. I'm leaving. And you wait for the salesman to literally chase you out into the street, begging you to come back, buy this car. So dumb. And she did this deliberately to scuttle Brexit. So when I tell you, I think I think her days are numbered. Now there's some talk of a deal on Brexit as long as she quits. I think this is all hogwash. Piers Morgan said it best. He said, look, what Great Britain needs right now is a Donald Trump. They need somebody who's strong, who's good on a negotiation, and who can whip all these wet noodles into shape. It's crazy. He's actually true. And I watched him, by the way, when I was in Zurich. I watched him on Good Morning Britain, which Piers Morgan is very entertaining. I'm going to tell you this. He's very entertaining. I watched him say it, and everyone on the show, he had an editor from The Guardian, he had his two co-hosts, and everybody on the show goes, what are you talking about? How can you? I mean, Donald Trump, he's such a despicable person, and he held his ground on this point. So I expect big things to be happening here, and I don't think that the Brexiteers are going to go into the sunset just that easy. I think there's going to be a bloody fight ahead. But this is all it is all designed to keep Great Britain in the European Union. It's all a bunch of self-serving pro-Europe politicians who totally want to subvert the will of the people. And the parallel to this, by the way, is what's going on in the U.S. with the Mueller investigation, Russia collusion, all of this. The desire to nullify the presidential election has nothing to do with substance or anything of the like. It's the elites stunned by the extent to which that they got it wrong and are trying now to turn back the clock. So watching this closely and hoping that things work out. All right, I've lost my voice. It's official. I'll come back next week and be in better shape. Have a wonderful weekend, and thank you so much for joining us. People.